Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
I'm Howard Feldman. This is Your Morning Mayhem. It's 101.9 Chai FM. Every second week, we chat to Jake Shepherd. He's a founder and director at Synthesis Software Technologies. Jake, a very good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Howard. Yeah, great. Had an interesting week this week. So,
well, that's what we wanted to talk about.
Lots of talking.
You spoke all over the show this week, but there was one particular engagement that you had where you were asked what I thought was some very, very interesting questions. First of all, tell us about this event, and then I'm going to look at some of these questions that you were asked and just pose them to you because they are really fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you. So I was invited to speak at, you know, as an opening speaker at a postgraduate workshop at the University of Johannesburg by Professor Cherise Harley. And she was doing a joint initiative with Professor Alan Cornell from the physics department. And they are heading up an initiative of really trying to use, how do you use, like, you know, data, big data, data engineering across all sorts of disciplines from like healthcare to mining, agriculture, particle physics. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to get interest, and they're trying to get like mutual consensus on how best to go about using data in all of these industries. So I spoke to one of the postgrad students who was doing some fascinating research from a particle physics point of view. You know, what they do is they like take all these particles and they smash them in these massive colliders. And you get all of this data that spews out of it. And traditionally, you've had humans like poring over this data. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to train machines to look over all this data to see if they can train the machines to see new particles or subatomic particles. But his nuance actually on this was not really to try and find those subatomic particles, but it was to try and work out how to explain what the machine's actually seeing, which I thought is brilliant, because you can imagine more and more we're going to have decisions made for us by machines or experts, like in the experts of the machines that are spotting these patterns and these trends. And normally, like when it's human experts, you can go up to them afterwards and you can say, like, how did you get to that? Like, what is your thinking?
You can interrogate it, absolutely.
To make that decision. Mm. You can interrogate it. But you've got a machine. Yes, maybe it's a great answer, but I have no confidence. Like, what's the thinking behind it? So I think what they're doing is like fascinating. They're trying to say, well, how can we get this integration of the machine and human society? But part of that is we have to explain to human society why that sort of decision has been made by the machine. And they're specifically looking for those decisions in how come the machine found that subatomic particle? Why did it think that was an interesting thing to look at? And it's one area. And I think that they're doing that across a whole bunch of different areas is really, really exciting stuff, and it's like groundbreaking stuff. Mm. It's nice to see that South Africa is involved in
absolutely
this groundbreaking sort of research. Yeah.
It is, but there's a tremendous amount of fear around job loss when it comes to this whole area. The flip side of that is also job creation and hope. I know they asked you to address this issue. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so part of my talk, actually I tapped into one of my first ever interview at Chai FM about the skills that one needs. We were talking about the lifelong learner skills and the human panada skills and the master storyteller skills. And as part of that, you know, I also discussed the fact that it's like pretty scary in today's day and age with the cognitive revolution, and machines taking more and more jobs away from human beings. So you can imagine, like, all these self-driving cars are going to put all the drivers out of work, and all of these like supermarket tellers, these automatic checkouts they, you know, invest, Amazon is looking at. Now, all of a sudden, a whole bunch of other people aren't going to find work. So that is really, really scary. And I was asked a brilliant question, which is, yes, we understand the fear, but where's the hope, you know? And what's quite interesting is I've often thought about this question from, like, what's the solution to all of this potential joblessness down the line? I've never had this question phrased in the fashion of where does the hope come from? Mm. I loved that question. It was a brilliant question. And my answer was actually, I think, you know, the enormous potential in human beings to reach in and find a solution to almost unimaginable things. So I can't really work out or envisage what the solution is going to look like. But I have faith in the human, you know, in human beings, and I have faith in human potential that we'll find something. You know, so there's a concept called the slow moving train wreck. So you can imagine that there's certain problems that happen very quickly, and then there's you almost got no chance of being able to solve them. Imagine like all of a sudden we find out that there's a meteor heading towards Earth, and we've got 24 hours left. Okay, there's almost no way of solving it. It's a fast moving train wreck. But a slow moving train wreck is like climate change. So we know it's going to be a problem in 50, 100, 200 years. We can see, and we've got enough forewarning. In that sort of situation, and I would say that this cognitive revolution, I think it's one of those slow moving train wrecks. We've got time. It's not as if it's all going to be out of work tomorrow. And we're not going to know what to do with ourselves. This is something that's going to unfold over the next 50 years. So whenever you have a slow moving train wreck, I have tremendous faith in human potential and in the ability for us to invent our way out of these problems, to see things and to actually understand. So one example of that could be like Elon Musk is doing some very interesting work with Neuralink, where he's tying in how to actually have some way of interfacing to the brain by like implanting a chip in the brain. So, and there's some very interesting stuff that he's doing there, and he's demonstrated in pigs. And showing how that you can actually get that neural interface working, including all the surgery stuff around it. And then what is actually – so if you extrapolate that, one of the potential answers is actually not ready. We just could tap into the power of the machine and just augment who it is we are and what we can achieve. And maybe that's one way of actually overcoming this and actually being able to remain relevant in this new world. I don't know if that's the solution, but I trust we can.
Isn't lack of hope rather about lack of imagination? Because as we develop certain things, maybe it's the supermarket checkout, I don't know whatever that is, so industries and needs build around that. And ultimately what happens is we shift our very manual jobs that a machine can do to others. And to other jobs that maybe require a little bit more human interaction, human maybe emotion, intelligence, something a little bit different. So doesn't it, you know, when we look at it and say, well, the machines are going to take over, you know, all of these jobs, and we stop the conversation there, it really does speak to, I think, to our lack of imagination or our ability to picture what's going to happened beyond that. I mean, there was that famous study that said a couple of years ago that said that when we were at school, half the jobs that exist today didn't exist then. And it's probably even more so now. We're educating our children for jobs that we don't know, for positions that don't yet exist.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. And I think the whole concept, I like your way of phrasing it, of the lack of imagination. I think it's so hard to imagine a reality that doesn't yet exist. And then even to go a step further, imagine what you could be doing in this new reality that you can't even imagine. So it's like those two steps of imagination that you're lacking. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think where people, a lot of the fear comes from is in the past, we've seen how we've adapted to the first, second and third industrial revolution. And we're struggling now to anticipate how we're going to adapt to the cognitive revolution. And I suppose what you're saying is right. Just as people had the lack of imagination before, like let's say the first, you know, those automated weaving devices, you know, those looms and those to automate, they didn't have the imagination. What are we going to do now afterwards? Maybe we're stuck in the same position now, just in a different era. We don't have the imagination to work out what's that next step. So that could well be part of it. And I think, but where the hope's going to come from, I think the hope comes from the boundless potential within human beings to actually, you know, adapt to change and actually find relevance for ourselves and invent relevance for ourselves.
Well, that immense potential is something that I know you focus on tremendously. You see yourself as a hero builder, or a potential hero builder. When people come into your organization, a lot of your focus is this person open to growth? Is this person capable of growth? And who can they ultimately become? Can I ask you, before we even look at how you view that, what do you define as personal growth?
Yeah, so this is actually, in many respects, people often find themselves saying, like, I had a personal growth, let's say, objective at one point in life, but now I've lost that, etc. So what I define as personal growth is really realizing that, our existence is really in two levels. We've got a conscious existence, we have the conscious aspect of our mind, and we have our vast unconscious. And I think one way of a metaphor is to think of our conscious mind as this raft floating on top of this massive ocean of the unconscious. And really, personal growth for me is, how do I tap in and make as much of this unconscious aspect of myself conscious? How do I actually take that which I don't know exists? So, for example, there might be a whole bunch of stories that I'm telling myself that I'm not even conscious of. Mm. And those stories might be self-limiting stories. In many respects, I think sometimes they're generational stories. They're handed down from generation to generation, and we don't even know that that's actually what's guiding our decision-making. And by making those conscious, we all of a sudden have the ability to start choosing a different path. We don't have to be forced down the same path that everybody else that came before us is forced down. And I think personal growth is really tapping in and making more and more of our world conscious, so that we can actually examine it under the light of day. You know, Jung once famously said that the unexamined life is not worth living. So maybe you can turn that around. It's life itself. It's the examination of life that is actually worth living for. And maybe that's the whole idea, is just to examine ourselves and to make ourselves more and more conscious. And that is what I perceive as personal growth. And then I think that lasts for a long period of time. You know, personal growth is not just for this phase of my life, is I've defined it as X. I think that definition for me spans.
I was going to ask you, is this for under 40s, or can some of us over 40s also continue with personal growth? And I love the metaphor, and I just want to reiterate for our listeners, is that metaphor of living, of being on a raft with this vast ocean beneath you, and which means that your personal growth is almost infinite. But the deeper you go and the broader you go, the more you expose what's beneath the surface, the more depth your life actually enjoys.
Yeah. So I found this question quite humorous, because from my own personal experience, if I had to try and equate, and I've been over 40 for the last 12 years or so, and I found my personal growth more in that period of time almost than I can imagine what it was before I was 40. I found it humorous, because, like, I thought, isn't that when growth starts? Is after 40? I didn't know.
Certainly, you know, I found that. My own experience is that my significant growth took place after 40. And I don't mean weight gain.
And I think there are two different types of growth. Mm. Yeah, no, listen, I did fantastically well in that scheme as well. But I think there are two different types of growth. So, early on in life, we're trying to deliver a life that is an answer to the question, is what does the world want of me? So the growth that you have there is really growth around, well, I need to have a career. It's like, what does my parents want of me? What do my teachers want of me? And then you get married, and it's, what does my spouse want of me? What do my children want of me? And I suppose it's to put bread on the table is one aspect. So it's really centered around answering those questions. What does the world want of me? And how to grow so that I can become somebody of value to the world, that somebody's going to be prepared to pay me for the stuff that I do. And that's what personal growth looks like at the beginning of one's journey in life. I think at some point in time, let's call it the second half of life. Another way of thinking about it is after midlife crisis kicks in, you start having to answer a different question. And that different question is, what does my soul want of me? And you are actually having to get in touch with what it is you called on to become. And that's a very different question. It's not that I think these questions are asked exclusively. First part of life is, what does the world want of me? And second part of life, what my soul want of me? I think they both asked at all parts in our life. I think what happens is, what is the primary question? What is the question that demands an answer? And I think in the first half of life, your growth is really around trying to answer, what does the world want of me? Second half of life, primarily it's focused on, like, what does my soul want of me? It's getting in touch with what it is you called on to become. So actually, I remember first part of life was all about software programming. And basically, how do I, use different languages to accomplish amazing things and, to build systems. And then all of a sudden, I realized actually I was called on to grow people. I was called on to actually create a culture where people growth is important. This is a totally different set of skills to what I had before. I can tell you, assembly language doesn't help you understand people. As much as I would have liked that to have been the case. So you've got to learn a totally new, different set of skills. You've got to learn a totally new area. And it was really, it was being in touch with, I'm energized when I'm with people and I can help them grow. That energizes me.
Which is so interesting because that wasn't, because you would never have, if you had been told this, maybe, or I'm imagining, and I don't know this for a fact, but I would imagine if somebody said this to you at the age of 33, that this would become your mission, you probably would have looked at them like they're mad.
I don't think anybody would have even imagined that they would need to say that to me, because that was just not me. I was very much focused on the inanimate, programming and the system.
Well, like, because to me, could making make sense people of it more. Was bizarre.
Yeah.
Probably because yeah, it could which make was very, more sense
which was,
of it.
And resonated, yeah.
Yeah, when you're looking at let's say a new employee and you're looking for somebody to join your organization in terms of that potential, what is that? Because not everybody is, and especially in a technology world, you would think maybe even more so, less open or maybe more afraid of self because and find comfort in, as you said, the inanimate. So what therefore do you look for in a person?
Yeah, so when we hiring, I think the two areas that we're looking for, the one area is an area of competence. So, like, do they have the skills needed to perform a particular job that we're hiring them for? And it's not just technical knowledge, it's also practice. Have they actually done that a lot? The other area that we're looking for in terms of competence is capability, i.e. do they have the ability to plan and to break down a complex system into its requisite smaller parts so that they can deliver it over time. And that's what we call capability. But the other area we look for is, what we call team player virtues. So we're looking for people who are humble, hungry, and smart. And I mean people smart, not IQ smart. And those you need in order for them to be team players. Because if you've got a big ego, there's no space for other people. And if you're lazy, you're not hungry, no one wants you to be on their team. I can promise you that. But one of the areas, I suppose, in the software world, we deal with a lot of people who struggle on the people smart aspect, as I'm sure you can be aware and I'm sure you've seen. So people who are innately drawn to software aren't necessarily innately drawn to people and how to interact effectively with people. So that's an area where I'm prepared to say, listen, if you don't have the people smart stuff, we can build on that. We can coach you through that. And it's an area where we really need to focus. But generally, we want people to actually have all three of those virtues, and we want them to actually be competent. We want them to have, the capability and the skill needed for that position.
Is that hard to find?
Well, if you're trying to find, let's say, for example, is it hard to find somebody who's good with everything? Depends what you're looking for. I think if you're looking for people who are hardcore programmers and you're trying to also find hardcore programmer with massive EQ skills, you're going to have a very, very small pool of people that you can choose from. I can promise you that.
So
if you're trying to go for the ideal employee with every single, every single aspect that you desire, I think then you're going to limit yourself in who you could potentially hire, and it's going to be a very small pool. But I think if you realize that actually certain things you can remediate, certain things you can assist with personal growth, and you can actually show people how they can grow and build these skills, and that some of these skills are very much learnable. Certainly those EQ skills are incredibly learnable. They just require, it requires dedication and effort. Then you can say, all right, this person I'm prepared to hire despite the fact that their people skills are weak.
Yeah, because they're prepared to
But let's say I was going in and I saw that this person was lazy. They didn't have hunger. They didn't want to do more and achieve more and really be hungry. That person I wouldn't hire, because to try and create hunger in a person is almost impossible. So that's interesting. That is somebody
so certain
that I would,
things
for me,
can be
a red flag.
Right. Yeah. So certain things can, skills can be learned, but others really can't. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We do need to leave it there. Jake Shepherd, founder and director at Synthesis. Thank you, as always, for your incredible wisdom. So interesting. Wishing you a wonderful, wonderful December and holiday, and looking forward to chatting to you in the new year.